Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Delta Flyers with Tom and Harry as we journey through episodes of Star Trek Voyager. Your two hosts along this journey are my fellow Voyager actor, who also played the role of Eric in the 1985 TV movie Ein Fenster in Manhattan, Mr. Robert Duncan McNeil, and myself, your favorite forever ensign, Garrett Wong. Remember, you can get the full version of this podcast by signing up to become a patron at patreon.com/the Delta Flyers. My, oh my.
Wow.
Just to let you know, in 1985, I was graduating from high school. And
wow.
So that became my freshman year at UCLA in 1985. And you were filming this TV movie, Ein Fenster in German, auf Deutsch, means a window in Manhattan.
A window in Manhattan? That's
yes.
What I remember.
Yeah.
Ein Fenster, I don't remember. That's so funny that you bring it. That's such a... long time ago. So
yeah.
I was in New York City. I had gone there to be a theater actor and then got into Juilliard, and
right.
I was studying drama. It was my freshman year. And we saw that they had a bulletin board in the, like, the student area. And there was an announcement for an audition for a German film. It was near the end of my freshman year, spring of my freshman year.
Right.
And so a bunch of us went in from school, you know, my class, some older classes, you know, seniors,
yeah.
and everybody.
Yeah.
I ended up getting this role, and I was thrilled because I hadn't really, I don't know if I had done much film acting, very little.
Right.
Anyway, I got this role, and it was a German little indie film, art film. It was a tiny little role, maybe one scene, I think.
Hmm.
I think it was just one scene where a German, young German man had come from Germany to New York City to find himself. And I can't even remember, but
wait,
it was,
you
kind
played
of like,
German then? You're playing a German.
No,
citizen.
I was playing an American.
Oh, you're playing American.
German,
okay.
Actor come over, and most of the film was in German.
Oh.
And the scene that I had with him, he was trying to find himself creatively, you know,
okay.
and who he was. And so I think a window in Manhattan was like a window into who his authenticity of
being
an artist and
yeah.
being creative and being who he really was. So,
but still, for being a first year student,
much about it.
Yeah, well, for being a first year student at Juilliard, and you see this bulletin board posting,
no,
and all of
crazy.
You guys, pretty much everyone, probably as a student, they're thinking, hey, I don't have an agent. I can go ahead and audition.
I think
for
a
this.
Lot
this
of,
great.
Yeah, it was an open
this
call.
Amazing. Open call.
Non-union.
Yeah.
I wasn't in the union.
Yeah.
A lot of, it was very exciting for me. I got
to
do a, you know, a scene in an indie film in New York City.
Most definitely.
I don't remember. So much of the script was in German. I didn't even know what it was about.
Yeah. That's fine, but still, you must have been so excited when you booked
it
thinking that, hey, I'm the one that landed this role. None of y'all, it was me. Woohoo! So,
yeah, that yeah. summer I got that role in the spring, and then in July I got my first TV job, which was The Twilight Zone
for CBS.
It was a reboot
yeah.
of The Twilight
mm-hmm.
Zone.
Mm-hmm.
So that summer was, after 1 year at Juilliard, I was like, wow, I feel like I've found myself as an actor
yes.
in a way that I had never had that kind of success before.
It's validation from the universe, right? You
yeah.
felt like, look, I'm booking. I'm still a student and I'm booking, which is
yeah.
a huge, huge deal.
Yeah.
Because at UCLA theater department, there is almost animosity towards anyone who booked anything in Hollywood
yeah.
while still being a student in the theater department. I don't know why
yeah.
that was the case, but there is that weirdness about, okay. You're out there auditioning already? I mean, there just seemed to be some anger from some students. I don't
yeah,
understand
why. Yeah, there
was
that same thing at Juilliard, but because
yeah.
it was New York City in the 80s, there was not much filming in New York, very
right.
little. So people were auditioning for plays. That was
yeah.
the thing. Everyone
right.
was trying to get a theater job in New York City or some, you know, Shakespeare in the Park in the summer, the New York Shakespeare Festival or things
yeah.
like that. That
yeah.
was where everybody's focus was.
Okay.
So this little German film was not, you know, on anybody's radar, really. And
yeah.
people weren't auditioning for TV shows.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
So let us go watch this episode. Memorial is the name of this episode that we're going to go check out. And we will be right back with our recap and discussion of Memorial. For those of you who are Patreon patrons already, please stay tuned for your bonus material. Okie dokie, we are back from watching Memorial.
Yes, we are.
You know, this whole episode to me, it's like moments of levity, of cuteness and funny lines, and then it goes straight down the pooper. I mean, it just gets so serious.
This was not a lighthearted episode at all. But I have to say, I really enjoyed it. I really did.
There were some very light moments within the episode. Some moments of comedy, some humor.
Now and then, but very rare. Much less than we normally have. This one was pretty intense.
Okay.
I thought, for me. Okay.
Well, I'm going to point out all those moments as we go through.
Okay, good. Okay, good. I want to hear them.
Let's start with our haiku and limerick synopses. And here we go with my haiku for Memorial. Long away mission. Crew have unexplained nightmares. Guilt can teach us all.
Oh, wow. That was very deep.
It was difficult to do. It was so difficult. I wanted to talk about your TV and all that stuff, but I couldn't fit that
in. A haiku is not a lot of real estate for deep stuff.
There's not even a front lawn. It's sort of like, you know, there's maybe a welcome mat. Yeah. that's how much real estate you get. Yeah.
But that's the whole point of it. It's just very brief.
It is.
Do you remember when we started this podcast, the synopsis that we would come up with where we'd try to explain just would go on for like 5 or 10 minutes? It was like
I remember you were doing it for a while, and you would meander. It would be the long synopsis for yourself and for me too, I guess.
That's where the poetry came from. We were like, we got to do this quick.
Yeah, we have to somehow condense this. So basically, the limerick is a condensing of the synopsis, but the haiku is even a further condensing, right? Yes. So you're just down to the essence at that point. All right. Don't make me wait any longer. Let me hear this wonderful limerick.
Here we go with our limerick synopsis for Memorial. The Voyager boys' mission was a success till memories of a battle caused them distress. Paris got a TV, but yelled at B'Elanna meanly, "It's really not fun having post-traumatic stress."
Nice.
There you go.
And haunting at the same time.
I got the TV in there.
You did. Yeah. You did. You squeezed it in. Good job.
Okay. You're welcome.
All right. Let's talk about directors, guest stars, writers.
Okay.
The whole.
Yes, let's do. Here we go. So our writer was Robin Berger, did the teleplay. And remember, we couldn't remember Robin Berger when we talked recently about her. But she was a very experienced writer. I just don't remember her at all. No. By the way, none of the writers ever came to set, except I remember Brian Fuller coming to set more than most, and Brandon every now and then.
I saw Brandon and
Brandon every now and then.
I saw Minoski every now and then, for sure. The one person I never saw was Berman. Our grand poobah. I never saw him.
He came down for the 100th episode. He came down. Sometimes he'd pop into, very rarely, into the hair makeup trailer to approve something last minute, like an alien makeup or something.
Yeah.
But he wouldn't come onto set.
No.
Yeah. So a story by Brannon Braga.
You got that right. You guessed Brannon. I guessed Joe. I said Joe Minoski. You said
did.
Brannon.
Mm-hmm. You did.
So you got that right. And you also got the director right.
Directed by Alan Craker. Bam!
Good guess. You got a twofer on this one.
Wow. Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah, I love Alan's work. It's so good. He's just a very talented man.
I didn't realize how many low angle shots there were in this episode. Oh, yeah. My gosh.
And also oneers, these long
oneers in the briefing room. It's just what is happening? Look at this choreography. It's amazing. And he really, really just, you know, he did a stand-up job on this one.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Guest stars.
Guest stars. We have a bunch of them this week. We have L.L. Ginter as Savdra.
Commander Savdra.
Commander Savdra. His very first job was a TV movie called Rita Hayworth, The Love Goddess. 1983, starring Melinda Carter as Rita Hayworth in a TV film.
What?
Yes.
Are you serious?
And Linda Carter
Wonder Woman was Rita Hayworth?
Rita Hayworth in a TV movie called The Love Goddess.
Oh, yes. God, I want to watch this. I really want to watch this.
And she was at the height of her, you know, fame and celebrity back then. 1983, for sure.
Oh, yeah. I am a huge Linda Carter fan.
I've always Well, he made his debut, his acting debut.
With Linda.
Yeah. We have Scarlett Palmer, of course, as Naomi showing up. We have an actor named Fleming Brooks playing Soldier One. Acting debut. This was his very first job.
Was Voyager.
Right. Yeah. And then his next job was Charmed the next year in 2000.
Yeah.
But his big job in show business was as an assistant to the producer with Casey Silver, who was among all the films he produced. He was a big Hollywood, big budget feature producer. He also ran Universal Pictures for a while. So he was the assistant to Casey Silver.
Oh, wow.
So he mostly did that. I think acting was maybe he was toying with it, but I think he ended up going into that kind of executive world, running
the
movies and things like that. Yeah.
Okay.
We had Joe Melis as young soldier.
Okay.
His very first job was the Lazarus Man in 1986 with Robert Urich.
Okay.
We had Susan Savage playing the alien woman that you murdered. Susan Savage.
That Harry murdered, yes. Or Harry's vision murdered. Okay.
Yes. Her debut was in 1987, Highway to Heaven, the TV series with Michael Landon.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that was Susan Savage's debut. We have Maria Spassoff as the female colonist. She was looking for a husband, I think.
Yeah, she's talking to Terrace at that point, right? Yeah.
Maria Spassoff, and this was also her acting debut.
Hmm.
The only other credit that she had on IMDb was a movie called Strangers Online in 2009. So she didn't do much acting. I'm not sure what else she did, but this was her, I guess I would say her biggest credit was that role.
Okay.
And we have two more. Robert Allen Calghezzi as the dying colonist.
You know who that is. That's the father or the uncle of the woman that Harry shot. Right?
Was that the older?
Yeah, the older gentleman. I'm guessing, right?
This is his only credit.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Yes, that sounds about right.
Mm-hmm.
Thought he did good. He died good. and last but not least, I want to point out acting role in this episode was done by David Keith Anderson, our
long-term stand-in. And I remember, I saw that and I was like, he got a line. He did, because I don't remember.
And he had a long close-up too.
Ooh.
When he was feeling the PTSD and Janeway comes over to him.
And it wasn't just a line. I mean, he had to be in a mood.
He had to have a little bit of
tears in his eyes. I mean, he was
great.
Yeah, he did a good
job. David was awesome.
I was excited for him.
So good.
Yeah.
All right. That's our actors. Lots of guest stars again. We've had this recently a couple of times with a lot of actors on the show. So.
And it continues.
Anyhow, all right. So we start the episode. We're looking into space, and here comes the Delta Flyer. It does a cool flyby. I love the Delta Flyer out in space. That was awesome. We come inside, and Harry's not happy.
No, he's not happy, but I wasn't happy with my line delivery either on that one. Because I think I should have said, someone left a dirty plate in the replicator and then just wait for it. Give it a beat, just a healthy beat. And then Tom. But instead I went, someone left the dish in the replicator, Tom. I just threw it out there. I kind of gave away.
I liked it. I thought it was.
You thought it was okay.
You could see that the four of us are getting a little stir crazy. We've been 2 weeks on this away mission, a 2 week away mission.
Yes. With a malfunctioning sonic shower. So we haven't had a shower in a while either. So,
And by the way, Tom never admits that it was him. So maybe it wasn't Tom. Like, you blame me, but maybe it wasn't Trump. Maybe it was Chakotay. Maybe it was Neelix. I don't know. But anyway, they're getting on each other's nerves. Yeah. And your hair, by the way, your hair was really
down.
It wasn't
coiffed at all.
I liked it.
You like it like that?
Yeah, okay. I like it. Like, all right. Loosened.
Carefree. Footloose and fancy free.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
It was good. You should keep that look. Neelix is also there. Chakotay's there. We've been on this two-week mission. We're finally heading back. And Paris sees Voyager up ahead. He calls them on the comm. He says 15 planets scanned in 14 days, and we've got a cargo overflowing with dilithium ore,
which is what we need.
Been a successful 2 week mission, and then we go into the hallway.
Yeah, and before the hallway, there is a very cool exterior space shot of the Delta Flyer kind of banking around,
going into the shuttle bay.
Yeah,
it was like cool. Shot. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then we cut to the hall.
Yeah, the hall.
And there's the doctor.
The greeting party is there, right?
The greeting party, which is the doctor and B'Elanna. Right. He's waiting. Yeah.
You guys do a lot of smooching right there.
I was waiting for you to comment.
Smoochy.
Yes. Yeah. A big welcome home kiss.
Yeah. There's a lot of elements going on in this scene, and it just like a lot of movement, but everything choreographed quite well, though. Everything choreographed very well, I must add.
Yeah. It was a lot of people. And I love when B'Elanna comes in. And by the way, we've never seen Tom and B'Elanna this PDA. Like,
yes,
she rushes into his arms like he's been away at, you know, on you know, overseas at war or something for years. It's like, wow. In fact, I think he does say, I should go away more often. Like, this is great.
Yeah. Harry's just annoyed. He just wants a shower. He wants his bed. And the doctor chimes in saying that everyone must have a physical. This is away team protocol. And he says all crew members must submit to a physical if the mission lasts for more than 2 weeks, which is now my first point of contention, because it didn't last for more than 2 weeks. It lasted exactly 2 weeks. You see what I'm saying? So there's a little, I don't know.
Well, that's why maybe we all refuse the everybody's splits up and heads off a different direction. And I just noticed that Bob Picardo was very excited to give everyone physicals. I was like, wow, I have never seen the doctor this excited for a basic routine physical. It was funny. It was funny to me. He was sort of left alone there with like a kid waiting to open his Christmas presents, and everybody just disappeared. It's like, okay. Yeah. See ya. We go to Tom and B'Elanna walking down the hallway towards his quarters, and they go inside, and she has a surprise for him. It is a television set. Yes. It's a television set from the 50s.
Yeah, but you asked if it's a naughty surprise first. Remember that?
Yeah.
It's a TV, a vintage TV from 1956.
Yes. Yes.
I love it.
She said she replicated the parts, but she assembled it herself.
Look at that.
She's put the love into it.
She loves it. She loves you.
Tom's a little critical. He says, you know, this remote is not authentic because they didn't have remotes for TVs in the 50s. And she says poetic license, which I love.
Yes.
And then he gives her a kiss, a big thank you kiss. It's very romantic. They're starting to kiss. And then a cartoon comes on. And Tom is more excited about the cartoon than the kiss, which I thought was really sad. Poor Tom. Poor Tom.
Did you notice the kiss was kind of on her corner of her mouth a little bit? I think maybe you were cheating towards camera. You guys were, is that
possible?
I didn't notice
that. Yeah, maybe.
I was like, they're not like directly on, like you were off to this a little bit further over on the corner of her mouth. So I thought maybe that was because you were on purpose trying to cheat towards camera to show more of your face, but who knows?
B'Elanna was giving Tom lots of kisses. He seemed more interested in the cartoon. She kept trying to give him kisses.
Yeah.
He says, oh, you forgot one thing. She's like, what? And he said, beer. So she goes to get him a beer. She comes back. She's filling him in. She's like climbing and hanging on him. And I remembered this scene when they got to that part.
Yeah.
Because I'm a little claustrophobic.
Oh, were you feeling that way when she...
as a human being?
Oh, no.
And so even though Tom's supposed to be watching a cartoon while she climbs all over,
yeah,
I remember filming it and feeling like oh my God, I'm having an anxiety attack. Like Roxanne is, and she's, I know that's what the scene is about, but yes. I'm just like, it's too much closeness. So I do remember that. I feel like I remember like sweating, like a little sweating because I'm like having an anxiety attack from claustrophobia.
And oh no.
It was, these romantic scenes on TV are not always romantic.
No, but also she hasn't draped herself over you like that in any other scene that you've filmed so far. So this scene was almost going to the nth degree in terms of your canoodling. And it was like, oh my goodness, she's all over you.
And I know it was for the story. I totally get it.
Yeah. But I love how you're kind of ignoring her. You played it well when you're looking at the TV, right? And she's joking with you. She's like, oh, you didn't miss much. The doctor gave a lecture on insects of the Delta Quadrant. Mm-hmm. Really boring until someone snored. And then the warp core overloaded. Then the Borg invaded and we were all simulated. And the whole time you're sitting there watching the television. And I said to Megan, I said, God, Robbie looks like a little kid right there. And right when I said little kid, she goes, with a beer. A little kid with a beer. Right? Yeah, exactly. Overall, it was a good scene. It didn't come off like you had anxiety over her draping herself over you.
Just claustrophobic. I'm claustrophobic.
I hear you.
She ends that by saying, you know, maybe this was a bad idea.
Right.
And then we have a little time passing and she's fallen asleep.
Yes.
Tom is still watching this television show.
It's like a gangster movie
or something. Yeah. And by the way, all the things that are on the TV, it felt, they were vintage, like commercials, cartoons, the gangster thing. And I remember as I was watching it, one of the reasons that they put in those vintage things is because they're cheap. Like they're almost free. Whereas if you were to put in a more modern television show or movie or something like that, you have to pay royalties. It's much more expensive, but the old stuff didn't have that kind of thing. So all that old stuff was not only creatively right, but it was financially a smart move.
Okay. So that commercial that they showed, the one where the lady, the jingle was mop, mop, don't stop, that mop, mop, don't stop jingle commercial. How much do you think they would have paid for something like that?
Probably not much at all.
Less than a grand, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Pennies. So, whereas if you get a clip from a famous, more modern movie, it could be tens of thousands of dollars if you could even get it.
Wow. Yeah. Gotcha. Okay.
But so she's fallen asleep. He's still watching this gangster show. And then suddenly it turns into like an alien battle.
Yeah, a futuristic battle scene is what it is.
Futuristic
right?
battle scene. Mm-hmm. And he's like, that's weird. And he tries to change the channel, or hit the remote. It's not working.
Nope.
By the way, in this shot, I did notice my orange background in my room. And I just have to say, I pick that color with the art department.
Yes.
Orange is my favorite color.
Yeah.
I'm holding up my phone. There's an orange case. I have a lot of orange in my life. I was happy to see the orange in there. So,
orange, you glad that you got to pick orange?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, even you getting close to the set doesn't change the channel, doesn't do anything. Mm-hmm. It's still stuck on this. And then you actually see yourself in the battle scene, which is now really freaking you out. Your character gets shot and next thing you know you fall back and you're kind of unconscious. We then morph into the credits, intro credits scene, but as we come back, you are shot in the arm, you're knocked out, and we basically have B'Elanna waking you up. And you know, she's like, well, maybe you need to watch something different. And Tom's like, nope, I'm gonna turn it off. So but this is definitely strange. Like there's no explanation. How can this happen? It's very Twilight Zone at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. He said, she said you were dreaming. And even when Tom like looks at the shot that he took in the arm, he's confused because it felt so real.
Yeah.
What he was a part of. And she says, I'll turn on those cartoons. That'll brighten you up. And I'm like, no, I've had enough TV. No more TV. That's what TV does to you, boys and girls. Be careful with the TV. It'll give you nightmares.
Yes. You even say something about that in this scene or the prior scene.
Too much TV.
Which I thought was hilarious because what are we doing? We're making a TV show, right? And in it, within the show, you're saying how TV's bad.
Don't watch TV. Exactly.
So at this point, at the end of this scene, instead of mop, mop, don't stop, Paris is going to say, mop, mop, please stop. You don't want to see anything else.
That's right.
Now we have the Jeffries tube scene. Yes. Harry is working on a section of the Jeffries tube. Either he's running a diagnostic, whatever he's doing, but he starts getting dizzy. He starts hearing...
Well, he's crawling too. He's crawling, which is going to be important in his vision.
Because it's a foreshadowing.
So he's crawling through and he's feeling kind of weird.
Yeah.
He gets to scanning the thing, the section. Hears some noises. Doesn't he hear some noises?
Battle sounds. And his vision starts to distort, but he does see the end of the Jeffries tube where the exit is. And that's when he starts crawling even more. Mm-hmm. And as he gets to the outside of the Jeffries tube, he kind of falls up against the bulkhead and he's just sweating profusely. And he's gone through some crazy experience. Yeah, he has no idea.
Kind of like when B'Elanna was crawling all over me and draping me. Harry is having his claustrophobia panic attack.
We're like Corsican twins. Whatever you feel, I feel. Yes. The same thing. So now we're in sick bay and the doctor is examining Harry and the doc thinks it's a plain old anxiety attack. And Harry says that he's never been claustrophobic before. And I made a note that that's funny because I, in real life, am similar to you in that I also am claustrophobic as well, very much so. Mm-hmm. And the doc says that the reason is you're just overworked and I recommend you to take the next 2 days off. Harry protests, but in the long run, he does comply with the doctor's recommendations. Mm-hmm. Still not knowing what caused this anxiety and this stress and hearing these sounds and noises. Now we do jump to mess hall where we have a very jumpy Neelix.
Yes, very agitated. He's chopping vegetables back in the kitchen. The water kettle hisses. He turns around with a knife.
Yeah.
He holds the knife up.
Which is like, what?
Okay, I just want to insert a question here. This is a Rebecca question. So while we were watching the episode, she had me pause. She says, wait a minute. Has Neelix been cooking for the entire ship all these years by himself? She goes, doesn't he have like an assistant? There's 160 people or more on the ship. And he seems to be cutting up vegetables. Shouldn't he have help? And I was like, well, there's
like a sous chef and like all these other
something.
Yeah, someone.
But it's a good point. Like Neelix has, I've never seen anybody helping him cook. He's always by himself. That's a lot of people. Like if I try to make a dinner for a dinner party, you know, or anybody, you try to make a dinner for a dozen people. That's a lot of work.
Yeah.
There's 160, 170 people on this ship. What? Anyway, good point.
It's a great point. And now that question has put everything into perspective for me, I'm going to say that Neelix is the MVP of Voyager.
Providing cooking all by himself.
150 meals per you know, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Yeah. So that's
for 7 years.
That's 450 meals.
That's a lot. That's
450 meals a day for 7 years
by himself.
Yes,
that's not fair.
Poor Neelix.
No wonder he's agitated.
He's very agitated.
No wonder he's pissed off. It wasn't the memorial. It was that he's been cooking by himself.
Naomi shows up.
Naomi shows up.
Even her arrival makes him jump. And she has been assigned a special project by Seven of Nine. Seven of Nine has given her this project to build a tetragon, but she has to use everyday things and not a replicator. So she is asking for Neelix's help. And she wants to use vegetables from the hydroponic garden, I guess. And he says he doesn't have time because he has a lot of work to do. So Naomi says, oh, well, maybe I can help you. And as she walks into the kitchen and she grabs a hold of a pot lid handle and she burns her hand very quickly. And she's like, ouch. And immediately.
But she just touches it. She's like, barely, ouch. Yeah, like exactly. It was hot.
Yeah. And even fine. She says, I'm fine. And he freaks out.
Freaks out. Exactly what I wrote.
Bay. Yeah. He says, get down, stay behind me. And it's like, what are you doing? You know, and no one knows
what's happening. Sick bay. Yeah. And then he sees some crewmen enter the mess hall. And that's when he goes, duck down.
Get down.
And he's
down.
Got his knife out still. Yeah. He's like freaking out. Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Very, very
disturbing. Yeah, it's
I
really
like seeing Neelix that way.
Yeah, it was very much just the way this was shot and how it developed. It was like a horror movie, really. This whole thing, right? Yeah. The next we actually have a battle scene, and the chaos and the craziness is happening, and it turns out that this is Chakotay's dream. He's dreaming it, and it's so real. The only thing that shakes him out of this dream is that Tuvok hails Chakotay, which wakes him from his nightmare. So we have a shot of Chakotay in his bed in his quarters, kind of waking up very quickly, hearing Tuvok tell him that there's a security breach in the mess hall, which of course is Neelix's crazy situation happening. And we head back to mess hall, and Neelix is still experiencing his hallucination of battle. He's holding Naomi tightly against him.
Like he's holding her like a hostage.
Like a hostage, exactly. Yeah. And she's really concerned.
Tuvok's there. Neelix is firing his phaser.
Oh, yeah. He doesn't have the knife anymore. He's got the phaser out.
He's got a phaser. Yeah. He's firing a phaser. Chakotay comes in, orders him to release Naomi. Mm-hmm. And then Neelix says something like, not until Savdra calls off his attack.
Right.
I was like, wait, what?
Yes, yes.
Clearly, and so now we're getting names of people in these memories and these dreams. Yeah. Savdra, the first time we've heard of Savdra.
Unfamiliar names. We have no clue about. Tuvok's strategy that he tells to Chakotay is that let's come up with some type of distraction. There's a back door. We can sort of, you know, overpower him. Chakotay doesn't want to have any bit of that. He's like, no. I've got a different plan.
I'm going to try something else. Mm. Yeah.
So he pulls upon his dream and he says, Savdra has called a ceasefire. The battle is over. Well, how come I still hear weapons fire? Oh, just random soldiers celebrating. That's it, you know? And that does the trick. That actually releases Naomi.
But what I found was interesting is as soon as he releases Naomi, they go over and help Naomi. He's still got, Neelix still has the phaser.
He does.
Like pointed in their direction.
Yeah.
And they approach completely defenseless. And I was like, Tuvok would not let this happen. Like you've got somebody who's acted crazy with a weapon pointed at you still.
Right.
I don't know. It seemed like a very quick wrap up to this hostage situation. And then the next thing that happens is Neelix drops his phaser, runs over to Chakotay's arms. He like collapses in Chakotay's arms and they sort of exit Chakotay holding Neelix.
Yeah.
Like the
actually, Chakotay, he doesn't drop the phaser. He hands Chakotay takes it from his hand. He hands it to another security guy, and that's what happens. So,
and then Neelix he's just exhausted from this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah,
yep. All right, so now we're in sick bay, and the doctor has given Neelix a sedative. Mm-hmm. He tells Janeway and Chakotay that Neelix has been suffering from a form of post-traumatic stress syndrome. Chakotay says that he dreamed of fighting in an alien war, and the same war that Neelix seems to be reliving. Mm-hmm. Doctor mentions that Harry had come in earlier dealing with an anxiety attack, and Janeway then starts to ask if they ran into any trouble during the away mission. Chakotay says no, that didn't happen. And the doctor says that Chakotay's engrammatic activities contradict that. His memories are real memories. They're not dreams or hallucinations. They're real. And Janeway says to Chakotay that maybe he was abducted and manipulated into fighting. And Janeway says that we have to retrace the mission, all the steps that the mission took and where they went, who they interacted with. She
asked through the sensor logs of the Delta Flyers. Yep.
She asked the doctor to revive Neelix. And she says that each of you seems to hold a piece of the puzzle. Let's see if we can start putting them together. Speaking of putting them together,
So Alan Craker shot this entire scene in a one-er.
That was a one-er, yes.
And I was like, holy cow. Like coming up off of Neelix and to the doctor and then Janeway and then moving around. And it was one shot, beautifully staged, beautifully shot. It had lots of different feeling moments in it. It wasn't a static shot. It was very active. And I was just thinking like, Alan had an instinct for these kinds of shots, but he couldn't have done it unless all of us were willing to play. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
I agree.
He could not have. Marvin and Alan always got excited about these sort of oners with movement, but I really want to give some credit to our cast too. Yeah. Like looking in that scene, you know, if Kate had not made the move she made, if Bob had not moved the way that he moved around the bio bed,
yeah.
the shot would have fallen apart. You would have had to have done coverage,
right?
You know, close-ups and things to make it work. So our cast, I thought, was really good at that, playing with Alan in making his ideas come to life and making them work in these one-er shots. He does it a lot in this episode, by the way. We go to the briefing room next. Chakotay, Paris, Kim, and Neelix are there. They are discussing their memories with Janeway. The doctor's there. They each are recalling different parts of... They're starting to put their memories together and piece together the missing parts for each other.
Yeah.
In fact, at one point, Neelix even says the Nakana. And then Harry goes, the Nakan. And I thought, oh, it was a warp particles moment. I thought you and Neelix could have had a warp. You could have gone, the Nakan together.
We could have.
Well, that would have been great.
That was our warp particles moment.
It was.
Yeah. It's just interesting because this whole scene and then the subsequent scenes, because we jump back and forth between the battle, the real life battle, and then the briefing room. Back to the battle, back to the briefing room. And every time we jump to the briefing room, these lines, just how they're just flowing out, it was very theatrical to me. It was very much like a stage play for me at this point. You know, it wasn't...
I loved it, though.
I did. But it wasn't our standard fare. Do you agree with me? I mean, typically when we're in the briefing room, the energy and the movement and everything and the way the lines are, it's not like this. It's not like this episode. It's definitely very different.
Yeah.
And very cool, though.
Yeah. We learned that they were called the Nakan, that we had all volunteered for this military assignment to evacuate a civilian population. Mm-hmm. We recall that Savdra was the commander of this unit in this scene. I thought this was... Everybody was adding, you know, I think what you're talking about is that we were all piecing together different parts and kind of reminding each other of these buried memories. And so it really had a team effort kind of feel to it in a way that it doesn't always.
It did. And what's interesting is that I feel like we were each remembering a memory of a different soldier.
Yeah.
If that's correct. You know, because I know later I'm jumping the gun, but the memorial has been there for hundreds of years. So it's sort of like, you know, losing its power. But I felt like, is that what it is? Like, it just assigns you one random soldier, or do you play the roles of every single soldier throughout, you know, your experience of listening to this? But at least in this early parts of this episode, it seems like everyone is a specific soldier. Because there's even in these scenes in the briefing room, there's, you know, somebody will say like, well, it wasn't our fault. And someone else will say, well, it definitely was. That doesn't justify murder. So there's a lot of this going back and forth where there's arguing amongst the soldiers themselves, it seems like, right?
Yeah.
Did you get that as well?
Totally.
Okay.
Yeah. I felt like each of us had a different version of guilt or trauma.
Yes.
You know, each of us had a different version. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But we do, out of this briefing room scene, flashback to the battle again. Savdra is giving orders to round up all the civilians and relocate them. And he says at this point, this is before the battle begins.
Right. We're in the command post at this point.
Yes. We're inside a tent. Exactly. And he says he doesn't want any casualties on either side. So it sounds legit now. I love Neelix at the end when Savdra finishes. Neelix is like, aye, aye, sir. It doesn't sound like Ethan Phillips or Neelix. It's like very military. I love that. Aye, aye, sir.
It is.
So we go back out of that moment and back to the briefing room.
Yep.
We're still talking Janeway and the doctor through the events that happened. And we tell them that we rounded up the Nakan, ready for transport. Yeah. Until we got to the last enclosure and we realized there were 24 unaccounted for.
Yeah, it was empty. an empty enclosure.
And we say, you know, we should have known something was wrong then.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And so this scene in the briefing room, again, is a one-er, this yeah. long one shot that's yeah. all connected. Yeah. And then when you go to the battle or the tent or those things, right. it's all chaos and handheld. I think that was very intentional by Alan to create these different visual styles between yeah. the remembering part that was all fluid in one long shot mm-hmm. and then the jumpy, chaotic battle. So I thought Alan did a great job.
It sure worked. Yeah. It definitely worked. So we're in the enclosure now again, and Chakotay calls mm-hmm. in the base. The colonists are ready for transport. One female colonist comes up to Paris's character and says that her husband's missing. He tells her not to worry and that she'll be on one of the transport. And all of a sudden we hear weapons fire, and they immediately think they're under attack.
Yeah,
and all hell breaks.
This is where the battle begins yeah. in the memory. We go back to the briefing room, another yeah. oneer. Mm-hmm. Paris says that it was the missing colonists, the 24 colonists that were unaccounted for. They fired the first shots.
Yep. Chakotay argues that you can't know that for sure. It could have been one of our own soldiers, fatigue, phaser malfunction. It could be anything. And mm-hmm. Neelix says, well, you know what? Either way, it doesn't justify what we did. And Janeway grabs Neelix and says, what did you do? What happened mm-hmm. down there?
And then we go back to the battle. Back.
Yeah, the battle.
So it's
yeah.
intercutting back and yeah. forth between us telling the story and seeing it.
Right.
We're back in the battle. There's shots fired everywhere.
Yeah. People start running. And yeah. this is when you see, yeah, it's a massacre. But this is when the massacre begins. This is when you start seeing colonists mm-hmm. getting shot. Did you notice that one of the background actors that is featured shooting at the colonists is actually our hair department personnel, Charlotte's son?
Oh, yes, I remember him.
Yes, I forgot he was in this episode.
He
was in the Fairhaven stuff with us. He's been a Borg before, and in this episode, yeah. he's one of the soldiers. Charlotte, who worked a lot on Jerry Ryan's hair, mm-hmm. it was her son, her adult son, that was in mm-hmm. this episode as a background character.
We go back to the briefing room, and Harry is very emotional.
Oh, my goodness.
He's really emotional at this point.
He's reliving it vividly.
Vividly. He said, we didn't have a choice. Mm-hmm. He said, I ran. I had to get out of there.
Yeah.
And as he's describing this and reliving it, we go back to the caves. There's Harry crawling
yeah.
through a tight, very tight squeeze cave.
Yep.
He gets into this opening.
Yeah. And before you continue with the opening, I just want to say that in the prior scene, the prior briefing room scene, Neelix does say that he tried to protect the children, but he couldn't mm-hmm. stop them. So that now kind of refers back to the scene with Naomi, like he's yeah. holding her so closely. So
that's right.
All right. Anyway, go ahead.
Anyway, so yeah, when Harry, we cut to his memory, Harry's crawling through this tight cave, and then he finds an opening, and there's this camp set up, it looks like. There's a kettle, a hot kettle. Mm-hmm. So Harry touches the kettle, it's warm. He knows that someone's around. Eventually he goes over to these big boxes that are stacked up and he hears a noise, knocks the boxes over and reveals a woman and an older man.
Mm-hmm. They're hiding behind the containers.
Mm-hmm. Harry says, how do I get out of here?
Yeah. Well, that's all he wants. He says, look, I'm going to leave you alone. I'm not going to do anything. Just tell me how to get out of this maze that and I love how she's like, just go back from where you came from. And I thought that was all that she was going to say, but then she added more instructions mm-hmm. when I thought that's mm-hmm. pretty funny. But I do remember crawling through that. It was just, I kept thinking about all the cats that were on that stage.
Oh, yeah. There were a lot of feral cats that lived.
Yes. And I kept thinking, I don't know if I'm going to get some type of, you know, inhale. I could be poisoned from just crawling through this.
It was not the most sanitary environment because the cave set had a lot of dirt on the floor constantly.
Yeah.
And the cats would go pee in the set.
Whatever they're going to do. Yeah.
So, and we discovered those things very often, quite often.
Right.
So,
and I had to do it twice. I had to do it as the soldier in the memory. And then later in the episode, I had to again crawl through that muck.
But there's the crawling back to the Jeffrey's tube.
Yes,
it sort of echoes that trigger for him.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, she doesn't trust Harry at first, but she ultimately tells him how to get out.
Yeah.
She gives him the escape.
Yeah.
And then he's walking away, but he sees the man reach for something or move.
He stumbles forward is what it
is. Oh, is that what it is?
And the minute he makes that stumble, it looks like a quick move to grab a weapon. So that's when Harry comes back and takes them both out.
He panics. He shoots the guy.
Mm-hmm.
He shoots them in cold blood, basically freaks out.
Yeah.
And then we cut back to the briefing room and Harry is also freaking out.
Yeah.
He was gonna kill me. Yes. Why?
They wouldn't listen. Why? Why wouldn't they listen? And then Tom comes over to easy Harry and kind of helps calm Harry down. The doctor also is there. But I was watching that and I thought that wasn't enough. I felt like I could have gotten more here. I felt like I could have had more flailing of my arms and just. If you're okay with it, that's fine.
I think everybody really let loose from Janeway to Chakotay to Neelix to you
and to Parasite. You too. Later, he loses it. Okay, so you had no issue with the level that I hit there. No, you didn't think it was too subdued.
No, I didn't.
Okay,
I didn't. I thought it was great. Chakotay says in the scene that ultimately 82 civilians were killed. No one was left alive. None of these
colonists
that we were supposed to evacuate, none of them survived.
All right, so next we have an exterior space shot of Voyager traveling through space. There is a captain's log supplemental. We have now entered the system where the away team conducted its recent survey, hoping to find an explanation for their memories of the Nakhon massacre.
Mm-hmm. Now we're in Paris's quarters. Paris is sleeping. It's a tight shot profile of him in the foreground there, but very agitated, not sleeping. He's trying to rest.
Correct.
I guess he's just, but his mind is racing. B'Elanna comes in. She says, I missed your breakfast. And she says that she downloaded more episodes of The Untouchables for him to watch.
Yes.
I love when she says, this is the one where they capture Al Capone. It's like, oh, Roxanne nailed it.
Yeah, but this, again, this is the lightness, the levity that I was talking about. These little tiny, funny, cute moments.
Little...
Al Capone was the cuteness right there. Yeah. And then poof, right out the window.
Yeah,
right.
Paris corrects her. It's Al Capone.
Yeah.
Very funny moment. I love that Roxanne got some punchlines because she doesn't normally get the comedy in our show.
Mm-mm.
And so I love that they handed her some jokes. But he says he wants to be alone. He doesn't want to be comforted. He's super, super guilty. She says maybe his memory was tampered with and he defends it. He says, I know what I remember.
Yeah.
I know what happened.
Yeah.
And she says, we haven't even analyzed the sensor logs. He can't think of sensor logs, he says. My big takeaway in this scene is, Paris freaks the heck out, like big time. I don't know if I ever yelled so loudly in the series as this.
No, you haven't. And I wrote that down. I said, this is the loudest that Paris has ever yelled. The other loud yelling time was in the episode Alice. But on a scale from 1 to 10, your yelling on Alice was about an 8 or 9. Your yelling on here was 12. It was off the scale. It was completely off the scale.
Lots of yelling.
Oh my God. I mean,
as I watched it.
Yes.
I love seeing Paris get out of patterns that he's often in.
Mm-hmm.
And as an actor, I felt like it was all authentic and motivated. It was big, but it was fun to, you know, my memory as I watched the scene was, that was an intense scene, but it was fun to do.
Like, yeah.
I enjoyed the process of playing out that scene.
Yeah, sad, you got to act. Yeah, you had a full range of emotions. And also, anyone watching this scene between you and Torres, who cannot relate to this scene where I think everyone has had an interaction with a loved one or a family member where they're just trying to help. And then what do they get back in return? A bunch of screaming and yelling and just, you know, it's such a resonating scene for me. And I'm sure other people have experienced things like this too. But again, you're right. This is the loudest Paris has ever been. I hope your vocal cords were okay after that.
I think they were. I think I was okay.
All right.
We go to Astrometrics next.
Yeah. And Seven is reviewing all the away mission logs, sensor logs. And here we go. Right off the bat, there is a little bit of a flirtiness between Chakotay and Janeway. You know,
Janeway, did
you see that? Of course. I mean, it's very clear. And again, this furthers my theory of this whole episode is filled with cute little moments and little funny moments. And this one's a cute, romantic, flirty moment for all the JC shippers out there. And then it just all goes to crap right afterwards. Because they're joking about the fact that, you know, there's a certain merchant that they came across, you know, and Janeway goes, oh, quite photogenic, isn't he?
Very photogenic, sarcastic. Yes, right. And then he had a formula that would stop them from aging. And she's like, you didn't happen to buy any of it, did you?
Yeah.
Touching him and then Chakotay smiling. Was like,
well, you know, it turned out to be this type of compound. It would have been good for shoe polish, but that's about it. So there's a little lightness and flirtiness. And then the Seven shows an image of the second stop they had on the away mission, which is this kind of off greenish color planet. And immediately Kate's face goes from light, happy, effervescent to dark. It's just like, it just changes in a split second. Mm-hmm. And she immediately recognizes this planet and immediately goes into reliving a memory of one of the soldiers. And she says, this is Tarakas, which is interesting because it's pronounced different ways in this episode. Janeway says Tarakas. Later, Paris, when we actually come upon the planet, we see it on the view screen, says Tarakas. So you have Tarakas, she has Tarakas. So it's tomato and tomato in this scene. Yes. And, you know, she is now feeling everything that's going on.
She's having the kind of memory, the living memory, the dream like we had.
Right.
She's now in battle.
She's in the middle of battle.
It flashes to her in the middle of battle. Mm-hmm. Chakotay's there. She hears shots. She runs over and she finds a soldier vaporizing one of the dead colonists.
Yeah. They're actually in a ditch. They're about one by one, right? They've all been laid out. And
they've all been laid out. Yeah. The dead bodies. They're vaporizing them.
She tries to stop it.
She's yelling like Paris was.
Yeah, and she got so mad. She's like, you can't do this. We can just tell the command what happened here. They'll understand that it was a mistake that we lost it. And they were like, nope, we're covering this up. So
he says, we weren't even here.
Yeah.
We didn't even see them. They weren't them here.
Yeah. Just
we disabled their shield generators, entered the colony, and nobody was there. Stick to the story.
Exactly.
So they're covering the whole thing up, vaporizing the bodies. Mm-hmm. And then we cut to mess hall, and Janeway jumps up awake from her hallucination.
Yeah. The doctor's there, Tuvok's there. Mm-hmm. She asks how long she's been out. The doctor says 3 hours. And mess hall's now no longer mess hall. This is overflow for sick bay. And Tuvok tells her, Captain, the whole crew has been affected. So everybody is experiencing these same hallucinations, these nightmares, these horrible scenes of battle and death.
I have a question.
Yeah.
This is a logic question. Mm. When we went on our 2 week away mission, as we returned, we were fine. We've been to that planet on day two, because when Seven's going through, they started here, they went there, and then the next day they were at this planet. So day two, we were at the planet. 12 more days go by, we don't have any symptoms.
Yeah.
But yet they get anywhere near this planet and the whole ship starts immediately, like literally, Janeway just looks at a picture of the planet and she has the symptoms. Something's a little not consistent.
I got you covered.
Why did it take us 12 days?
I got you covered. Okay. So that beacon, that memorial, which is transmitting these images for people to relive, it's 300 years old. Okay. So, and we already know at the end, it's faulty. It's kind of malfunctioning. We have to repair it. And so basically, whatever transmission it sent to us was very weak. It took 14 days for it to manifest.
But then when we got closer, it had a surge.
Yeah. And something happened. Right. And then it became much
more. As long
as
we have an explanation. Why is this happening so fast?
I'm going to be the debunker for you on this podcast. I'm going to debunk everything. So that's going to be my explanation for that, which is possible, right? I mean, you could buy that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the mess hall is filled with the crew members that are having this PTSD, and the doctor says, we need to get out of here.
He says we should reverse course.
We should reverse course, leave this area. Hopefully everyone will be better. Janeway says, we need to know if we were really part of this. If this was real, or if this is just an implanted memory. She needs to know. Yeah. So she says, set a course for Tarakas.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the scene, the doctor gives her a neural suppressant to try to subdue these hallucinations and memories.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and we also see David with his lines too. So
we see David there
with the ensign. I don't think he gets a name other than ensign, right? She's like, ensign, I've seen you look better than this, and we'll get through this. He's like, yes, ma'am. So he had a nice little moment there and good screen time for David. And I'm so proud of him and happy that he got that chance. Because a lot of times I don't remember anyone from background getting lines, but here we go.
No,
we have
very
a shot
rare.
Right now. Yep.
We do stay in the mess hall. We see Seven bring Neelix a snack. It's one of his favorites. Talaxian stew and Terra nut souffle.
Mm-hmm.
And Seven says, when Naomi is sad that she consumes desserts, maybe you should try that. It's like, another funny line. There are funny moments.
But am I right? See, everything starts like, ha, 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 and then goes, wah, 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 right?
Neelix feels really guilty about Naomi, that he, traumatized her. Yeah. He asked Seven when she was a Borg that she assimilated millions of people. Does she feel shame from this?
Right.
And she says that, yes, she feels remorse, but her remorse helps her not repeat what she did before, prevents her from repeating it.
Yeah.
And that to me was like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. She even says about shame or remorse that it can be difficult, but also very useful. And Neelix says, yes, it certainly is difficult. And then he looks over at that Terra nut souffle and he goes, is that chocolate? And she says, yes, I improvised. She altered it or something. And he reaches over and takes a bite of the Terra nut souffle, which, by the way, he's wearing dentures. Those are fake Talaxian teeth. So I was thinking about Ethan eating the food and going, oh, that must have been just messy in his mouth because he's got dentures and some kind of food.
They probably would have had to take those dentures out and clean them, brush them good, get all the gunk off of
take
there.
Two.
And do it again. So,
yeah.
Yeah. So it's just one little quick talk with Seven and he's a little bit more of himself. He's able to notice that there's chocolate in the souffle. And now we have an exterior space shot of Voyager approaching Tarakas or Tarakas, however you want to pronounce it. And now we're on the bridge.
Yeah. They're approaching the planet. They scan for vessels. There's no sign of vessels. She says, take us into orbit. And Paris goes, ma'am. Now he says, ma'am? Didn't say yes, ma'am. He said, ma'am?
Yeah, that's where something's up.
Yeah. And she goes, do it. She's got her angry voice. But
take away that TV from you, Mr. Paris.
Yeah, so Voyager goes into orbit. We have a planet shot. Very pretty planet. Looks
it
green.
Is.
It looks very lush. Mm-hmm. Unlike the battle look that it had, which was pretty scary.
Yeah.
The bridge says no life signs, no weapons residue, no snow. Evidence of this battle that happening here. Harry looks at the sensors. By the way, when you're looking at the sensors, the shot was from the side. You were leaning way over, like much more than I normally did. Do you remember if Alan said, like, can you play that lower or lean into it? I don't know. For some reason, I was like, oh, that's a little different than usual.
Yeah, I think he did. I think he did make that direction. He was like, just for the shot, do you mind, doing something a little awkward? And, we all love Alan Craker, so we will do awkward things for him.
I'll
twist my body the wrong angle degree and feel
it looked
like
a little. Yeah, it looked a little dirty. You weren't standing up the normal.
Good catch, Robbie.
But you do find a power signature
on
the planet. You locate it, you find this power signature. So there must be something down there.
Northern continent, I think, of this planet. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We go to the hallway now. and there's an Ocean's 11 shot. It's like the heroes walking. It should have been in slow motion.
It should have been.
Come around the corner.
No.
All heroic, pulling the weapons out. We're ready for battle.
Oh, my gosh.
Get onto the transporter pad.
Yeah.
Checking the weapons. Janeway says.
Phaser rifles.
Phasers. Everybody checks their phasers. We're pretty cool. We're pretty badass.
I hit a button on top of my phaser rifle.
I know.
They added the sound in post.
Like a little click.
Yeah, a little click. Yeah, just powering up. Yeah, that was a pretty cool shot right there. I agree.
We beam down to the planet. It's a very lush, beautiful green planet.
Yeah.
I remembered filming this stuff as when I saw this. We were out at the Disney Ranch.
Yeah.
We shot out at the Disney Ranch, which is out near Santa Clarita, maybe, or somewhere out in that direction.
Right.
My very first TV, broadcast TV show was The Twilight Zone in around 1984 or something.
And you filmed it there?
We filmed it there.
Oh, yeah. My gosh.
We filmed at the Disney Ranch.
It's like a homecoming for you.
In fact, when we were filming at the Disney Ranch, Twilight Zone was premiering that year.
Yeah.
We're filming our episode. Another show called Amazing Stories.
I remember
very
that.
Very similar show. Steven Spielberg was producing that show. They were filming on the Disney Ranch that day, and Clint Eastwood was directing that episode.
Oh, wow.
That TV episode of Amazing Stories. And I remember they wrapped me a little early for lunch, and this was before cell phones.
Yeah.
There was one payphone on the Disney Ranch lot.
Oh, my God.
And so the driver took me back towards base camp to the trailers, and I went to the payphone to call my girlfriend back in New York City where I lived. And
what?
Yeah, I went to the payphone.
Oh, this is
at
sorry. This is you're talking about Twilight when you were Zone. Filming. Okay, I thought I was like Twilight your girlfriend. What? Okay, no. Gotcha.
When I was 1984.
Yeah,
I'm living in New York.
Yeah,
going to school. I'm still at Juilliard.
You're at Juilliard. This is before you got married.
But I come out to do this Twilight Zone episode. First time in California. I'm filming on the Disney Ranch.
Yeah.
Amazing Stories there, Clint Eastwood. It's very Hollywood feeling.
Yeah.
To me, I was overwhelmed. So I go back to use my calling card. Remember you used to have to punch in like 1-800 and then you had to put in your code and then the number you want to dial. It was like all these numbers you put in.
Yeah.
Use my long distance card to call from the one payphone.
Yeah.
And I'm talking for a while, filling her in and how exciting. And I notice a line starting to form behind me. For the one payphone, and I'm like, oh, honey, I should probably let let people, I think we're broken for lunch. I gotta let people, and I hang up. I turn around, and it wasn't our crew; it was the Amazing Stories crew.
Oh God!
And Steven Spielberg was standing in at the front of the line,
waiting to use the phone,
waiting to use the payphone at that same location where we filmed this episode. That was. And I turned around, he had the hat on, he was kind of short. And I was like, oh my God, it's Steven Spielberg. Cause they broke for lunch and it was their crew. And since he was Steven Spielberg, he was up front waiting for the payphone. Cause that's what you did.
Oh my no God. Cell phone. I thought you were going to tell me that it was Clint Eastwood.
No.
And then he was waiting and then
never saw
you didn't want to give up the phone. And he was like, you're feeling lucky today, punk. And he was getting all like a Dirty Harry on you. But
no, and Steven was very nice. He was like, thank you very much. Thank you. And because he must have heard me say, oh, there's a line, so.
Yeah. And it's, well, I'm glad that you brought up the location because I was going to ask you if that was Griffith Park, but it's not Griffith Park.
It was the Disney Ranch.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now there is a, at conventions, we bring various photos to sign. Mm-hmm. And there's a photo that I have of you and me holding our phaser rifles up in the air and smiling like a funny smile with the same background actor that loads onto the transporter pad with us.
Oh.
So it's the you and I and the background actor holding our guns up and we're like our phaser rifles and we're like making this funny face. And for the longest time, I was like, gosh, I wonder what episode this is from. And now I know it's from Memorial.
Now you know.
So yeah, because we did some. Yeah, because, we always have a set photographer that would show up for 1 to 3 days of our 7-day filming schedule. And that day when we went to the Disney, what's it called again? The Disney Ranch.
It's the Disney Ranch film studio.
On that day when we went to Disney Ranch, the set photographer did join us on that day. Mm-hmm. And I asked him if it's okay if we posed a funny photo. And I grabbed you. I go, Robbie. And I grabbed the background guy. And I said, hey, let's all take our phasers and tilt them the same angle and have a funny laugh on our face, a look on our face. And he took that photo.
That was the episode.
Yeah, that was the one from that episode.
That's funny.
Mm-hmm.
That's funny.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a beautiful planet. Great location, Disney Ranch. Janeway says, search the area. We're kind of going through. Harry's kind of leading this part of it. He's leading the way. He remembers where the tunnel, he remembers the tunnel. Mm-hmm. So he's trying to find his way towards the tunnel. Janeway and Chakotay are scanning. Janeway detects a faint signature. Mm-hmm. So they go off on their own. We go back to Harry's group. We do find the tunnel entrance. Paris says, Tuvok, there's your physical evidence. Because Tuvok's been skeptical. So I had your back on this. I'm like, Harry proved it. So I thought that was
thank you for having my back. Do you also remember how heavy those phaser rifles were?
They're pretty heavy.
Like they were not made of balsa wood. They were made of like the hardest wood known to mankind, the most dense, heavy wood that they could possibly find. And I remember taking off my wardrobe at the end of that day, and there was an indentation of where the strap was on my skin. And I was like, that's not even funny. I was like, you guys can't find some type of fiberglass to make this out of. And instead of this very weighty,
they were heavy.
Yeah. So heavy. And I was shocked to see that I had that, you know, strap indent in my skin. Yeah.
So we're climbing in the tunnels. We go into the tunnel. We cut over to Janeway. She's scanning a little deeper in the woods. Inside the tunnel, Harry's crawling where we saw him crawl before.
Same place. We're
back at the same place. He's panicking. Tuvok says, take some deep breaths.
Yeah.
Harry pauses for a minute. He does. He calms down. He moves forward. We get back to this opening.
Yeah.
The same kettle. All the things are there. Cobwebs
now. Cobwebs. Heavy cobwebs. Clearly, this did not happen 2 weeks ago. We know that, right? And we even
cobwebs are spiders. So they have spiders on this planet.
Of course, there's alien spiders.
Yeah, there's spiders. Okay, spiders. Okay. But Harry goes in. He points to the corner. He says, that's where they were.
Yeah.
Tuvok goes over. He finds the skeletal remains.
Yeah. And the same wardrobe is sitting on the ground where the clothing was too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But Tuvok scans the skeletons and he turns to Harry. He said, you are not responsible for their deaths.
Yes.
And in that moment, I was like, how does he know that? And then he goes, these skeletons are over 300 years old.
Correct.
You couldn't have been here.
Yeah.
So
there's no way. Unless we jump through some type of time warp.
You know, time warp. I'm going to go with it wasn't us.
Okay.
anyway, outside, Janeway and Chakotay come out to this open field. They see this giant monument, which I remember the set piece was only that bottom pedestal. It was maybe 10, 12 feet high.
Right. The rest was all CGI. They put that in post. But didn't it also, I made the note, after that many years, would there really be a clearing like that? You know what I'm saying? I mean, there's no one's lived there for hundreds of years. That beacon, that monument should have been covered in vines and it should have been completely overgrown at that point, I thought.
Maybe.
Interesting.
Maybe they put down some
weed killer that kind of lasted
some Roundup. Centuries. They just did a bunch of Roundup around
Roundup Deluxe, Roundup Extra Strength Roundup.
Delta Quadrant Roundup.
Delta Quadrant Roundup.
Killed all the vines. It's good. Good for 300 years.
Good for 300. Good for 300 years or your money back. Mm-hmm. Right? Now I can hear that 50s jingle. Mop, don't stop. So, all right. Let's continue.
But they do find this. She scans it. She said, I think we found our war. Go to Astrometric. Seven's explaining that this structure contains a synaptic generator powerful enough to permeate the entire star system that the planet is in with neurogenic impulses.
Yeah.
So that anybody that comes near here will experience the massacre.
Yeah, a very this huge synaptic concept here.
Yes, a synaptic transmitter.
Right.
But it transmits visions of this massacre into the minds of anybody within range.
And as if it was their real memory.
Yes. Mm. Yeah, as if it was their own memories and they remember it as if they were, you know, a part of it.
Yeah, such a crazy concept. But
And then they, very cool. And then they read the inscription. I wrote this down because I love.
Oh, yeah. Read it.
That Chakotay reads. Mm-hmm. He scans the alien writing and has Seven.
Seven do it. Yeah.
Seven translates, uses the translator matrix and interprets what's written on this memorial. And Chakotay reads it. And it says, words alone cannot convey the suffering. Words alone cannot prevent what happened here from happening again. Beyond words lies experience. Beyond experience lies truth. Mm. Make this truth your own. I love that.
Super poetic.
Whoever wrote
super
that,
cool.
idea in that way. It's just really powerful.
Robin Berger wrote it in that way. So
it was
good job.
Really, really cool.
Very powerful. And I like how it showed up on the screen. Like it was the crawl in the original Star Wars movie of all the letters coming on basically. But yes, very, very emotional, very moving.
Yeah. They realized the memorial's over 200 years old and that it's deteriorating. And that is why their memories are so fragmented.
Right.
And Chakotay wants to shut it down.
Yeah.
But Janeway seems very distracted here. She's like thinking, she's got another idea clearly. We don't know exactly what.
That's when we cut to mess hall at that point?
We cut to the briefing room.
The briefing room. Excuse me. Yep. I wrote that.
Go to the briefing room. Mm-hmm. And that's where we are arguing about what to do.
Yeah. Basically, Neelix says we do not have the right to deactivate the transmitter. If we do, it destroys all the evidence and we are no better than Commander Savdra in trying to, you know, enact this cover up. And Janeway is kind of, you know, as we're all debating this, Janeway's off to the side. And so all of a sudden she silently makes this decision and she says, nope, we're not going to shut down the memorial. The 82 colonists who died here, they deserve their memorial. And Janeway suggests that we repair it, recharge the power cells and make sure that it lasts for another 400 years. And we're going to go ahead and place a warning buoy in orbit so that anyone who enters this system will know what to expect. They're not going to get broadsided by this. And it's a good plan. And this is the way, this is what we go with because she's the captain.
Which I think is, you know, she really wants to honor the intention of this memorial and but also give clarity to other people that might be surprised by it like us.
Yeah.
To say that there is a memorial here and it will give you the memories of this horrible tragedy that happened. So
we have an exterior shot of Voyager in orbit over Tarakis. And the next shot is basically of us on the planet surface at the memorial. It starts off pretty cool. It's like above all of us, basically. Yeah. We look down upon us. And I think even that's all CGI as well, then, right? Yeah. Even the crew members. And then as it comes down to surface level, we see that we are making all the modifications. And by we, I mean Tom Paris and Harry Kim are making repairs to the monument as Chakotay, Neelix, and the captain look on as we do all the hard work, basically. But we beam out of there. And as we beam out, it just sort of ends on a shot of the memorial and the power source, the ball starts to glow a little bit, right?
Re-energizing, so, whatever adjustments, improvements we made are working. This thing's going to work as it was meant to. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
There you go.
Woo. Yeah. This was one gripping episode.
Yes, it really was to me. I thought it was great.
What's your lesson? Did. What are you going to get out of this? I mean, there's a couple of lessons.
One lesson is always get your checkup on time instead of avoiding it like we did. Because if we had gotten our checkup when the doctor said, come get your checkup, we could have maybe prevented all of this confusion. So go to the doctor, get your checkup on time. That's one lesson.
What's your second lesson then?
The other lesson is,
say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
That the truth of the past can be painful for all of us, all kinds of true, you know, events that have happened in our past or in history. But by remembering those truths, that we can prevent ourselves from making the same mistakes. So that was sort of
my real lesson. Yeah, the lesson
was the
kinda...
doctor. So was get your checkup. But but the more emotional lesson was.
Your second lesson is pretty much in line with what Seven said to Neelix in the mess hall, which is, you know, my feelings of remorse helped me remember what I did and prevent me from taking similar actions in the future. Mm-hmm. So that is, again, the lesson that I came up with. Same thing. So, make sure that the lessons from the past will inform the decisions of the future.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. What is your rating for this episode?
I am going to give this episode I'm going to say 8.2.
Oh, we're very close.
What are you?
I had originally written down 8.2, but I'm, as we've recapped it, I'm going to up it to 8.5. I think this was a really good episode.
I'm going to say that the captains and admirals average rating is going to be 7.6.
Really? Mm-hmm. Well, let's see, because I have it right here.
Okay.
The captains and admirals average rating for Memorial. I said 8.5. You said 8.2. You think they're going to be...
I thought they were going to be lower. Maybe. And then that's because of what happened last week. So yeah. I'm sort of affected by that.
I'm sticking to my 8.5. This is a good episode.
Yeah.
7.8 is the average.
Oh!
7.8. Wow.
How well did I hit that average? Wow. Huh? I 0.01 off.
I'd give it an 8.5. This was well written, well acted, a really powerful idea. Mm-hmm. It involved the whole crew. We had moments of levity, not as many as we often do, but still plenty.
Yeah.
Really well directed by Alan Craker. Great writing. I stick with my 8.5, but I respect the captains and admirals average 7.8. I totally respect it.
Yeah.
Still good.
Good.
There you go.
Okie dokie. We're done with Memorial. On to the next. All right. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in this week. Join Robbie and I next week when we talk about the episode Tsunkatsu.
Yeah.
All right.
That'll be fun.
Okay. Patreon patrons, please stay tuned.